It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, thousands of people around the country were hospitalized last year for a lung sickness potentially linked to vaping. We'll talk to a Wisconsin reporter about the latest numbers in Wisconsin and around the country and how the Trump administration is responding. First, you might still be writing your 2020 New Year's resolutions, but one resolution you might have neglected, getting closer with your friends. It's not always easy to do that as adults with busy lives. But our next guest says there are big benefits that come with having close friendships and some tangible steps we can take to try to build them. Sue Johnson is a clinical psychologist and author. She's also the founder of the International Center for Excellence in Emotionally Focused Therapy. Her work focuses on bonding, attachment, and romantic relationships. And you can join in with your own suggestions, stories, and questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. Do you find it harder to make friends as you get older? Have you found it hard to keep friends at whatever stage you are in life? Do you have that one friend you can count on? They'll be there for you, as the song goes. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Sue Johnson is with us. Sue, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, you're most welcome. Happy to be here.
Is it common that people find it harder to make friends as they get older, as they move on in life?
I think to a certain extent, but hopefully, especially if they're listening to all the folks that work with me, they've started to understand about the key things that create a friendship. And so maybe they can be more deliberate about making their friendships. But in a way it is, because adults go off and they get caught up in their own lives and their jobs and, you know, working too hard, and they don't spend the time to, they don't play on the rugby team anymore, and they don't go out to the school dance. And so in some ways it is, but hopefully we get better at it as we get older.
Before we get into the how of things, let's talk about the why. What are some of the, some of it seems obvious, but what are some of the benefits of having friendships and close friendships in particular?
Well, over the last 20 years, psychologists have really started to understand the nature of bonding and just how important it is. And it's incredibly clear, by which I mean there's like hundreds of studies on this. It's incredibly clear that as human beings, we need this sense of intimate connection with a few other people on this planet the way we need oxygen. And that, you know, we've kind of put that down in our society a bit. We've seen it as somehow that adults shouldn't be needy, or that there's somehow you're supposed to be self-sufficient. I tell my colleagues the only self-sufficient human beings are dead human beings. We're born to bond with, to connect, to be with others. And all the research is very clear. If you have one or two others, a partner or a really good friend that you can turn to, that you feel has your back, that you confide in, that you matter to, your whole nervous system responds to that. You tend to be calmer, more resilient, more sure of yourself, more confident, more able to deal with the world. I could go on and on and on. I mean, it's literally like it impacts your physical health. You know, the best predictor of whether you have another heart attack or not after the first one isn't the severity of the first heart attack. It's the quality of your most intimate relationship, which is one reason why we've just created this big program for cardiac couples and their partners for a big hospital up in Canada. I mean, it's getting clearer and clearer that we are not just social animals. We're bonding animals. And we need close connection with other people like we need oxygen.
Sometimes I think we focus on quantity, how many people like my post on Facebook or Instagram, depending on my age, or how many people show up at my birthday party, over quality. Is that a mistake?
That's a huge mistake. You know, it's really, we're not talking about social media. You know, I don't know why people call them friends, because they're not friends. You know, basically, most time you never meet all these people. A friend, a real friend, is someone who, when you're down and vulnerable, you can tell, I'm really down and vulnerable, and they'll take you in their arms. That's a friend, and you don't do that over the internet. So there's lots of research that actually, in spite of the internet, we're becoming lonelier and lonelier in our society, and it's a mental health, physical health problem. It's not just icing on the cake to have friends. It's loneliness is, it's kind of like, I think of it as like, you make somebody lonely without these close connections and knowing they matter to somebody else. It's like taking a fish out of water. You know, the fish will gasp for a little while and survive. But basically, our water, the water we swim in, our ecological niche, is close connection with others. And if we don't have it, we don't do well.
Talking to Sue Johnson, clinical psychologist, founder of the International Center for Excellence in Emotionally Focused Therapy. We're talking about friendships, the why and the how to build closer, maybe more intimate friendships. Sue, let's get into the how. You know, as a kid, we could ask somebody to play on the swing set with us and see if something blooms. As adults, it's harder to pull that off. What are first steps that we can take to try to build a closer friendship?
Well, I think part of it is that it's who you choose to connect with. You know, we, like, I couldn't have said this to you two decades ago even, but basically we understand now that there's a structure to your emotional life. There's a structure to DNA. There's a structure to your intimate relationships. And all the research tells us that the quality of an intimate bond in the end is about emotional responsiveness and openness. So we help couples. We've been helping couples for the last 30 years. We get the best results anywhere on this planet for helping couples repair their relationships. And we talk about hold me tight conversations. When couples have these hold me tight conversations, it predicts success at the end of therapy and them having a great relationship years later. It predicts intimacy and satisfaction and all these good things. And what is a hold me tight conversation? Hold me tight conversation is where both people can be open, accessible, responsive, and engaged. The big question is, are you there for me on an emotional level? ARE. Are you accessible, responsive, and engaged? And in good relationships, the answer to that question is yes. So the issue is, you know, my kids, when they're starting to date, said to me, okay, Mom, you know, you're so clever. How do I pick a boyfriend? I say, hey, girl, you know, never mind. What you're telling me is you want the best looking guy in the room. You know, how about talking to guys for a bit and seeing who gives you eye contact, who responds to you emotionally, who's interested in you, who responds to what you say, that you feel like they're tuning into you, they've got you, they're connected with you. That's the guy to follow and try and make into a friend.
There's a stereotype, a cultural belief anyway, that men are worse at this kind of thing than women, that they are less willing to have that intimate connection, especially with maybe another guy as a friend. True or false, Sue?
Well, I hate to say it, but I think it's basically true. But let's be clear here. When I say it's true, I don't think we're talking about the inherent nature of men.
Right.
Because all the research says that when you take little boys, little tiny boy infants, they're just as emotional. They're just as needing connection. They respond to love and care just like little girls do. So it's not about biology per se. It's about how we socialize and all our ideas about what masculinity is. You know, it's like I work with a lot of military folks and they'll tell you even now, you know, that basically if you're going to go into war, you've got to suck it up. Well, maybe you do have to suck it up, be able to suck it up if you're going into a war situation. But you try to live in a permanent state of shutdown where you're not open and you're not responsive to other people and you don't let them in and take risks. You don't let them see your vulnerability. That's the issue. We've taught men that somehow it's unmasculine to be vulnerable, which is insane. I mean, you've got the same nervous system as a woman has. You've just trained it differently. What we see in therapy, which I love, is that when we work with men to help them repair their relationship, or when they do our relationship education program, our Hold Me Tight relationship groups, which are all over the U.S., that when men come into those groups or into, you know, a therapy, they respond just fine because we basically give them safety and tell them, we want to hear about your vulnerability. It's okay. You're a human being. Like, you know, what's happening for you right now? You're shutting your wife out because you're telling me you feel like you're failing. Have you ever thought of turning and telling her, it hurts to feel that you're disappointed in me? And the guy looks at me and says, are you insane?
Oh, no.
And I say, no, I'm not. Try it. And he does. And what he blows his mind is that his lady bursts into tears and said, I didn't know you felt that way. I just thought you didn't care. I didn't know that you were worried about that. I'm only disappointed because I don't get enough of you. I'm not disappointed in you. I want you. These kinds of conversations, these conversations with emotional connection, they change the dance between intimates, friends or partners. They're the basis of our loving bonds. And if we understand them, we can intentionally create them. We don't need to wait for the magic to come and hit us in the head.
We're talking to Sue Johnson, clinical psychologist whose work focuses on bonding, attachment, and romantic relationships. We are talking about friendships, why we need them, close friendships in particular, and how to build them. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have close friends in your life? If so, what do you think it took to build that closeness? Did it feel natural for you, or did it take some work? Have you developed strategies if you've, say, moved from one place to another on creating new friendships, or moved into a new workplace or stage of life? Or do you need some advice from our guest on how to build these kind of friendships? Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Sue Johnson, clinical psychologist and founder of the International Center for Excellence in Emotionally Focused Therapy. She has advice for us today on building and sustaining better friendships, no matter what stage of life we're at. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What have you noticed about making friends as an adult? Easy? Difficult? Little of both? How about close friendships? Has it been difficult to keep friends close through changing life stages? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to your calls now. Nathan is with us in Eau Claire. Nathan, hi.
Hey there. I just kind of wanted to hear your guys' thoughts on gratitude journaling and how the research is kind of shown how people that may not fully appreciate the relationships that they are, after doing a little bit of that, are able to develop those relationships a little bit more, like, intimately.
And gratitude journaling, Nathan, that's just what it sounds like. You keep a journal of things and maybe people you're grateful for. Is that right?
Well, whether it's people, just, you know, daily things, but I think it's pretty important when it comes to that social anxiety or that other aspect of developing your closer relationships and maybe making you appreciate them a little bit more.
Nathan, thank you so much for calling and bringing that up. Sue, what do you think?
I think Nathan's got a beautiful point here. And what speaks to me is that one of the things we see couples do when they've repaired their relationship and they feel safe and connected with each other is they give each other validation and appreciation. You know, it's kind of like we've sort of got out of the habit of that somehow in our society. We're all so busy, we go on to the next thing. And, you know, what we've learned in our work, working with people over the last 30 years, is that it's so powerful to turn and say to somebody, you know, I was in a session the other day, and this man turned to his wife and said, you know, I don't want to shut you out. I don't want to turn away from you. So I'm just going to tell you what's real for me right now. I don't know what to do. And that's, I feel like I should know what to do if I'm a man. I don't know what to do. And his wife teared up. But if we just left it there, you know, nothing much would have happened. But she turned up and I said, teared up, and I said, can you tell him exactly how you're feeling right now when he says this to you? And she says, I'm amazed at you. I feel like you've let me in. I don't need you to solve my problems. I need you to be there for me. You're so brave to have said that to me. I never understood that. I love you. You're my special one. You can make mistakes. And then he teared up, and you know, and new things start to happen in their relationship. So validating someone, you know, I think hopefully we do that with our kids. We say, oh, well done. You know, you were scared, but you went down the slide. But somehow when we're adults, we act like we don't need it anymore. And we do. We need for people to, yeah, say, I have gratitude for you. Thank you so much for, you know, I said to an old friend the other day, I really appreciated you sending me those two emails when you heard that I was having a medical problem. You know, you didn't have to do that. And I appreciate your thoughts. Thank you so much. It made a difference. Well, that lights up her world. So yeah, gratitude is important. And the thing about it is, when you give that to people, you create safety. And emotional safety is the essence of a good friendship, a good emotional connection.
Nathan, thanks for that call. We'll go to Lynn now with us in Eau Claire. Lynn, hello.
Hello. Fascinating subject, and thank you. I moved to Eau Claire from the Chicago area about 30-some years ago, four kids. My husband's job brought us here. It was very, very difficult to break those ties, and new ties have not been made. But my sister and I, my remaining sibling and I, they're there for you. They grew up with you, you know, and even though we're miles apart, that's been a bonus.
Yeah, I hear you. And there is something about those attachment bonds in our family. The issue is, of course, some of us don't have those. But, you know, if you do have those attachment bonds in your family, I mean, they're the ultimate resource for a social bonding human being to know that, you know, you can call somebody and they're going to want to hear from you, that your pain and your happiness matter to them, that if you need them, they'll be there. You know, knowing that somebody knows you, sees you, sees you for who you are, accepts you, has your back, this changes the world. You know, without that, the world becomes a very lonely, potentially dangerous place. And that's our emotional reality. That's how our nervous systems respond. That's got nothing to do with us being somehow not mature or somehow weak. That's just the way we are as human beings. So I think it's great that you could turn to your sister and find that connection with her.
Lynn, thanks for sharing that with us. We're talking to Sue Johnson with the International Center for Excellence in Emotionally Focused Therapy. We are talking about friendships, building and maintaining close friendships, and why they're good for us. Back to your calls now. Christian joins us now from Milwaukee. Christian, hello.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Christian?
So it's funny, last night being New Year's and all, I ended up alone at the end of the night, got separated from some friends. So I'm at home and I just wanted to hang out with somebody. It's New Year's. I'm not completely sober and I want to talk with people. And so I have VR, right? And so I actually went in and I watched an app called Big Screen, where basically you can either watch a private movie on a big screen or you can be in a virtual movie theater. But, yeah, I mean, I met a guy from Sweden, another guy from Alaska who there's a lot of towns in Alaska with Russian populations. So that was interesting. But, yeah, it's just really cool. It's almost like the days where instant messaging first came out and people were joining in chat rooms, only it's so much more personable because even listening to you guys had a story about some guys that, like, would conference each other through VR. And they never met each other in real life, but when they finally met each other, they felt like they had even more of a connection because they could even read each other's body language. And it's just a cool time to live in.
Interesting, Christian. What do you think, Sue?
Oh, I think that's really resourceful of Christian to do that. You know, and hopefully, cross fingers, that's where the internet's going to go. Not so much for this tweeting and messaging and saying everything fast to, you know, 300 people who you don't know at all. Hopefully we can start to use the internet to really connect us and to have that kind of face-to-face contact. Hopefully we can. We can start to use it like that because that's important. I mean, I love the idea of that he was alone on New Year's Eve when we all think that we should be with somebody. And personally, I was sleeping, but but you know, I love the idea that he was alone and he went to what he knew, but he used it. He used the technology in a way that made him create a real connection with somebody. You know, he reached out to somebody who was also alone on New Year's. You know, it's one of those moments, New Year's, I guess, when we all somehow feel like, what? I don't know, we're all supposed to be in a wild party or something, or at least in somebody's arms, right? And so it's hard for us. It's hard for us when that's not happening.
Time for it. Thanks, Christian, for calling. Time for one more call from Jeff in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to share there's two go-to places I have where I want to meet friends because I like meeting new people. Is in the wintertime, I'll go to a curling club. I always meet people that are interesting and friendly in a curling club. And in the summer, I often go to horse racing events. And I know it's worldwide as a sport, but those are two places I always go and I always meet friends.
Jeff, thanks for that call. In our last minute, Sue, getting ourselves out there doing stuff with people with common interests.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. But I also want to emphasize that you can get out there, but if you don't reach for people and take some risks and let them see you and respond to them in the emotional channel, the trouble is those relationships can end up being really superficial. So the more we know about how, you know, caring works, love works, intimate connection works, the better, because then we have a choice. We can actually know how to create these intimate relationships. You know, shared activities are great, but I don't think they're enough.
Jeff, thanks for that call. And Sue, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're most welcome. It was really fun. Nice to talk to you guys.
You too. That's Sue Johnson, author and clinical psychologist who founded the International Center for Excellence in Emotionally Focused Therapy. She was with us today to talk about why we need close friends in our lives and how to build those relationships. Coming up after the news, vaping became a big public health concern in 2019, especially with the rise of bootleg vaping cartridges. We'll talk to a reporter who's been covering the issue in Wisconsin about how doctors and the federal government are approaching it. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, postpartum depression is a common problem for new moms. A UW researcher tells us we need more info about new dads dealing with depression, too. First, vaping devices and e-cigarettes got a lot of attention last year after thousands of users were hospitalized with severe lung illnesses. While doctors worked to pinpoint the cause, Milwaukee authorities uncovered several illegal vaping operations. And this week, the Trump administration rolled out its plan to partially regulate flavored vaping products nationwide. Mary Spacuzza is an investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She's been covering this story over the last year. Mary, good to have you back.
Thanks so much for having me.
2019 was the year that vaping became this public health concern, people getting sick with mysterious lung illnesses that potentially appeared at first to be linked to vaping. We know more now. First of all, where do we stand in terms of the numbers we've seen in Wisconsin and around the country?
So last week, the CDC came out with new numbers saying now there have been 2,561 patients who have been hospitalized with what's being termed vaping-linked lung illnesses. It's in all of the states, District of Columbia, two U.S. territories. 55 deaths have been confirmed. Luckily, none of those deaths that have been confirmed yet are in Wisconsin. So that's one positive for us here, is that nobody's actually died. But, you know, we've seen a lot of people, a lot of teenagers and adults getting sick from this lung disease and or lung illness, lung injury. And, you know, originally, I don't know if you remember back to this summer, it was actually Children's Hospital of Wisconsin,
right,
who held a news conference and said, like, you know, basically we've seen a string of teenagers coming in, and the link here appears to be vaping. We've learned more about it since then and have learned that most of them do appear to be connected to people who have vaped THC, the psychoactive ingredient in marijuana. They're looking at this vitamin E additive of looks like what kind of, you know, bootleg THC vaping products it's added to kind of expand their profits. That seems to be what the federal officials have called a very strong culprit in this. But it has, you know, whether or not they haven't ruled out tobacco products or, you know, e-cigarettes in that whole outbreak, but it also really, I think the illnesses really drew attention to what has been deemed to be an epidemic of youth vaping across the country, where so many teens, so many young adults have reported vaping, getting addicted to vaping. So it's really kind of set off a firestorm and a lot of different regulatory changes being discussed.
Right. E-cigarettes and vaping, even the legal kinds, are big business. You and your colleagues at the Journal Sentinel have been following these bootleg products, and these have been really big business here in the state for sure.
Huge business. We, Raquel Rutledge and I, who've been working on these stories, were shocked at what some of the profits that were being reported out of the black market sales of e-cigarettes, and that could be, there were places in Milwaukee that were being raided with just insane amounts of cash. One had like an entire, one of those plastic bins full of cash in there. I think it was in a closet. There was a family that was operating out of Racine and Kenosha that was reportedly making just money hand over fist on this stuff. So it is very profitable. You know, obviously marijuana might be legal in some of our neighbors, but not here in Wisconsin. And illegal vaping and THC sales are a big business.
Talking to Mary Spacuzza from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the latest on e-cigarettes, vaping, bootleg products, and health concerns, especially linked with those bootleg products. Mary, you mentioned regulatory changes coming when it comes to e-cigarettes. What kind of things are you watching for?
A while back, President Trump announced what he at the time said were going to be, you know, essentially sweeping changes to e-cigarettes, and talked about how the First Lady was very concerned and that he was going to make big changes, banning it for people 21 and under. Originally, he talked about a broad flavored vaping ban. He's since backed away a little bit from the flavor ban. Congress did approve raising the age to 21 for e-cigarette and tobacco sales. So that was approved. That is done. In terms of the flavors, though, now instead of banning all flavors, it's that a lot of the kind of major retailers like gas stations, convenience stores, they won't be selling those tutti frutti or fruit and sweet flavored vapes, which have been connected. A lot of people think that the teens are kind of being, you know, targeted when you see something like something flavored after a candy. However, there's a very popular flavor, menthol flavor, that is still going to be widely available. That is something that a lot of adults said, like, well, we like the flavor. Vaping advocates, pro-vaping advocates were saying, well, this is helping me quit smoking, and if you ban this menthol flavor, I'll go back to smoking cigarettes. Obviously, a lot of the anti-smoking activists are very disappointed by the changes. There's also some other loopholes in this flavor ban where essentially it would ban those kind of prepackaged candy flavors. However, vape shops would have a lot more flexibility in terms of the flavors that they're selling. So, critics are saying this is not really going to stop teens from vaping.
We've talked to some public health experts here in the state who point toward, we've had this years-long decline in tobacco use by teens, and now all of a sudden, it's still early days from a research perspective, but we see nicotine addiction going back up in part because of these e-cigarettes. That's what people are concerned about with these age sales regulations, right?
Right. And just when they hear about, when they see the numbers of how many teenagers reported vaping and, you know, vaping in school bathrooms, hiding it in your sleeve. I think people have been alarmed by just how prevalent it is among teenagers and young people.
Well, let's go back to another piece of the puzzle now, the bootleg products with THC. As you mentioned, people were making big money until they got busted and raided. But if some people were making big money, presumably someone else will try it too. What are you seeing when it comes to enforcement on these bootleg operations?
You know, I think by the huge busts that we've seen recently, you can only think that there are plenty of other people who haven't gotten caught yet, and that there are other people thinking like, well, if they were making that kind of money, I can make that kind of money too. You know, obviously those who advocate for marijuana legalization or medical marijuana legalization say this could cut down on safe bootleg products because people could buy THC or, you know, buy marijuana products that were produced in a regulated environment where certain safety protocols are being followed. Obviously, I'm sure that somebody who's an opponent of marijuana use would say that making it legal will just make it more prevalent. But, you know, I think that there are real concerns about what's being put in these bootleg THC products as seen by vitamin E acetate and things that could be doing irreversible damage to young people's lungs. And we really don't know what the long-term effects of that will be. You know, we heard of these kids who couldn't bend down to tie their shoes or had trouble breathing if they tried to raise their hands to shampoo their hair. That's pretty alarming. You know, a lot of them have luckily recovered, but what will the effects be when they're trying to go back for sports this fall spring? What will be the effects 10 years from now? We really don't know, and I don't think people like the idea of using teenagers as lab rats.
And to look at what this looks like from the perspective of the end user, the person who buys these products, you and your colleague Raquel Rutledge had reported a lot of these bootleg operations, they were buying these, you know, official-looking labels online, these things that looked like they were, you know, mass-produced corporate products. And people might think, oh, well, this is illegal here in Wisconsin, but it's legal in other states. This is just the kind of thing that if I cross the right border, I could buy legally in a store. They are being fooled if they think that.
Well, yeah, some of these labels, like the labels that we saw that were seized in some of these raids, they were probably bought in, I think a lot of them were bought in China, mail ordered, gotten through the mail and arrive here looking, you wouldn't know. You would think that, oh, this was probably from California or someplace where somebody got it from a dispensary and this was a legal product because they look so professionally packaged. But I would not assume if you're a teenager in Wisconsin looking at something that looks official that it is and that you actually know what's in there. And you're not buying it from a dispensary. You're buying it from somebody who bought it from somebody who, you know, and you just don't know.
As we wrap up, Mary, a lot of pieces to this puzzle. What are you watching for in 2020?
I think we're going to be looking for who's profiting off of the sales, how Juul responds, the company in San Francisco. And Juul does work with a lot of contractors. Raquel and I reported a contract manufacturer here in Wisconsin, Phillips Medisize, that does a lot of contract work for Juul. We're not entirely sure how much, but there's clearly it's a big business. And I think we'll be looking at what regulatory changes get through. There's been resistance. You know, obviously, when President Trump announced the regulations before they were scaled back, there was a lot of pushback from people saying it could cost him the election, and a lot of critics. And I think that we've seen that in the state legislature here, too. So we'll be watching what bills pass and who's resisting those changes.
Mary, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Mary Spaguzza is an investigative reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She talked with us about the concerns over vaping-related illnesses that arose last year and how doctors, law enforcement, and federal regulators are responding. Coming up, there's been growing attention to the mental health needs of new moms in recent years. Our guest says that's good news, but we should also watch out for depression among new dads. Find out why coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, should a nonprofit group refuse to accept money from a person or business who's done things that are illegal or unethical? an expert on the ethics of giving, joins the show for a look at some recent high-profile cases of philanthropy with a cloud over it. First, it's estimated that 1 in 7 women will experience depression during or after pregnancy. Experts are pushing for more screening and more therapy recommendations for expectant mothers. Our next guest says the attention to things like postpartum depression is important and it's needed, and that we need to look at the mental health of new fathers, too. Tova Walsh is an assistant professor of social work and an affiliate of the Center for Child and Family Well-Being and the Institute for Research on Poverty at UW-Madison. She contributed to the recently published paper, A Call to Action, Screening Fathers for Perinatal Depression. Tova, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get to the dads, it does seem like there's more attention to depression during and after pregnancy. Still more to learn, though. Talk about the more recent focus on mental health for moms.
So there's been an increased focus on attending to perinatal mental health in moms, including a call from the American Academy of Pediatrics for pediatric providers to get involved in screening moms. And they're recommending that providers screen moms at multiple time points throughout the infant's first year. A couple of other groups have also issued recommendations, and so there seems to be a real consensus among medical professionals that it's really important that we be focusing in this area, and I agree with that call.
And it's important for the moms, also important for the kids, right? A depressed mom, and we'll get to those dads in a minute, a depressed mom, if she gets treatment, it's going to help the kid.
That's right. So what the research shows is that obviously, you know, caring for moms is really important in its own right in terms of mom's well-being, but also that child outcomes are really impacted by maternal depression. And so anything that folks like pediatric providers can do to support moms in getting treatment they might need is really to the benefit of children and families as well as mothers themselves.
Now, I've heard a lot less about dads soon after childbirth, new dads with a new kid in the house. What do we know, if anything, from the research out there when it comes to things like depression among new fathers?
Well, there's a lot less research on depression among new dads compared to new moms, but there is a substantial, you know, substantially growing body of research. So we're really starting to get a clear pattern to the findings, which is that dads struggle too around the birth of a new baby. And, you know, I think it makes a lot of sense when we think about the variety of changes that parents and families go through when welcoming a new baby. Many of those changes are relevant to dads as well. So thinking about, you know, all of the adjustments in terms of balancing work and family obligations, thinking about changes in the relationship between parents and just the, along with the excitement, kind of all the stress that comes along with sleep deprivation and taking care of a new baby and trying to figure out how to, you know, keep up with things that are important to you while also being a caregiver. You know, many of those things are experienced by all new parents. And so it makes a lot of sense intuitively, I think, what we're finding in the research, which is that new dads are at higher risk for depression compared to men who are non-fathers.
And that's, I guess, an important lesson for men and women with new kids. I guess I always assumed a big part of postpartum depression for the mom was this huge physical event that they had just been through for 9 months plus recovery time. But there's more to it than that. These other factors, it's a big life change that they're going through, too.
That's right. So the biological changes are a piece of it. And then there's also all of the kind of social and environmental factors that go into it. And so for fathers as well as for mothers, you know, a whole lot of changes. And some of the risk factors are similar. So for fathers, like for mothers, when they experience less social support, when they are struggling in the relationship with their partner, if they have a history, a personal history or family history of depression, all of those things are risk factors for depression around the birth of a new baby.
Talking to Tova Walsh from UW-Madison Center for Child and Family Well-Being, assistant professor of social work as well, looking at depression among new parents, how to treat it, and why dads should be part of the picture too. Tova, you just mentioned some of the causes might be the same for men and women with a new kid in the house. Does it look the same, though, or does it manifest similarly between men and women?
So we're seeing some differences. So some of the symptoms, you know, that parents present with are similar. So things like, you know, depressed mood, feeling sad a lot, you know, struggle to enjoy and engage in activities that used to be things that the parent enjoyed. Those are common across mothers and fathers. But one thing that is can be different in dads is that they are more likely than moms to do what's called masking their symptoms by engaging in behaviors that are avoidant or numbing. So things like spending spending more time at work. Things like increased substance and alcohol use can also be symptoms of depression. And it's important for us to keep an eye out for those in the lives of new dads, since we may not be used to thinking about those as symptoms of depression.
If we're going to start thinking about dads and depression with a newborn in the house, from the healthcare community, what kind of things do you think would need to change to, I guess, screen for this, part one, and then treat it?
Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, it's really wonderful that there's this momentum around screening for moms in pediatrics. And I think there's opportunity for pediatricians to be involved in screening dads, too. So we have research that shows dads are increasingly likely to be showing up at well-child visits throughout the baby's first year. And those visits are opportunities to screen dads. And so by checking in with dads, by asking them similar questions to those that we're asking moms in terms of how they're feeling and how they're doing in this stressful transition period, that's an opportunity to recognize depression. And then the next step is getting dads connected to treatment. So at that point, it's thinking about who are the referral sources in the community for therapy, whether a dad might need support with his parenting, if one of the things going along with his depression is struggles with bonding with his baby. But so pediatricians, I think, have a key role to play in identification, and then it's going to, we're going to need participation from all kinds of health and other professionals to provide the support that dads might need to cope with the depression that they're experiencing.
Now, Toa, there's historically stigma surrounding mental health problems, depression included in that. Plus, this is a very sensitive time of life for a new parent. Do you think that there could be pushback here, parents resisting being screened or treated for depression, given those two facts?
I think you're right. I think that's a reasonable concern to have. And I think one way of getting out in front of that is to be doing more in terms of public education. So having conversations like this to try and normalize and make it clear that, in fact, this is a common problem. So it's not a reflection on an individual not being able to cope well, that this is something that, in fact, there's a pattern to this in new parents, both mothers and fathers. It's a time of vulnerability when you're having a new baby. So some normalizing is really significant. And I think prenatal providers, as well as pediatricians, can be part of that normalizing by speaking with parents and helping them to anticipate the possibility of depression in both mothers and fathers, so that people are kind of ready to recognize if they themselves or their partner is struggling, and to know that that they can ask for help and that there is help out there that could make a difference for them.
Well, there's a question. Is there help out there? Do we have enough access to the kind of mental health care that at least some of these moms and dads might need?
So I think we need, I think we need more access to the kind of help that both mothers and fathers might need. And the kind of access varies, varies in different communities, varies depending on the resources available to the family. So another piece of this is thinking about what resources are available and really building capacity so that we're ready to respond when we identify depression.
You mentioned at the outset there that we have some research on dads and depression, but not as much as we need. What kind of research do you want to see happening out there?
Well, for one thing, for the most part, when we are screening dads for postpartum, postnatal depression, often what we're doing is using measures that were developed for new moms. And so those measures may or may not be really well suited to assessing and documenting symptoms that fathers are experiencing. So we have more work that's needed in terms of figuring out the best ways of screening. We also need more research to understand the patterns and progression of paternal depression, and to understand impacts on children and families. So there is, a growing body of work that's showing impacts not only in the short term, but even children across childhood and into adolescence who grow up with a father who is depressed in the early years. We see that there is a lasting impact on their well-being. And so understanding in that longer term what the impact is, I think, part of establishing the kind of, energy and commitment that we need to intervening early.
In our last few moments, Tova, it sounds like a message for the new parents out there. If they're feeling these signs and symptoms of depression, is that they're not alone. Other people have experienced similar problems, and maybe there's a road to getting through it.
That's right. So absolutely, other parents have experienced similar problems. And I think, along with that, the message to new parents is, that it's normal, and that all parents, have ups and downs with new parenthood. But if you are experiencing, you know, depressed mood or increased irritability, symptoms that really last and detract from your ability to enjoy your new baby and kind of carry out your usual daily activities, then it's time to seek help. And that your own healthcare provider or your child's healthcare provider could be a go-to person for getting connected.
Tova, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Tova Walsh from UW-Madison, co-author of a new paper called A Call to Action, Screening Fathers for Perinatal Depression. A British company surveyed its customers about the best cartoon cars ever. They released the results. So here's the top three. They got a top 10 list. Number one, the Jetsons flying car. Number two, Scooby-Doo's Mystery Machine. And number three, the Mean Machine from Wacky Races. Glad they got in there. Dean Knetter, Central Time producer, has opinions. Dean, hey.
Hey, Rob.
What did you not like about this list?
I was shocked that they left off the Magic School Bus.
Right. Now, it raises the question, is a school bus a car?
Well, the mystery van from Scooby-Doo, the Mystery Machine is on there. That's a van. And what is a bus if not just a long van?
Right. And the bus is definitely, the Magic School Bus is a character in and of itself in many ways. And it can do a lot of cool stuff.
It can shapeshift. It's responsible for the entire show. It's named after this bus. If not for that bus, these kids are just sitting in a classroom.
Okay. Any others, omissions that you would like to see here?
Ooh, honorable mentions. I got to say, Cruella DeVille's car from 101 Dalmatians was pretty neat. That's a good matching of character and automobile.
Okay, now further down the list here, we have the Flintmobile. I don't know if it was called that, from the Flintstones,
oh, yeah.
Where you have to run. Now, I had a buddy who had a El Camino back in the day with the passenger seat floor rusted out, so we could have tried to run it like a Flintstones car, you know.
And if you would have made a cartoon about it, it could be on this list.
I think we're going to quit our jobs and write that cartoon, Dean.
Better late than never.
All right, good talking to you all these years. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back.